You get one thing kind of right. You ready?
Run with it.
Narrative. Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We are the Bell Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Hello.
Brent Powell.
Hey.
And Tanya Gates.
Hi everybody.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Happy New Year officially. We recorded that last episode towards the end of last year. We are now in 2021.
Nice. Dark. We made it.
Outrageous.
Yeah, well, look, this is still, you know, we're still in very much in the middle of things, but you know, there's something about the turning of the calendar, that page or whatever, onto a fresh start, and I hope that folks are being optimistic about this year. I know I am, and looking forward to everything that we talk about and bringing you shows week after week.
Well, I figure, like, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, like, Gandalf has just returned, Gandalf the White, like, the Turn of the Tides, and even though we've got, like, the Battle of Minas Tirith and Pelennor Fields again ahead of us, like, it's looking better than it was.
Maybe we can convince the Eagles to get us all the way there this time.
Let's return to that metaphor at the end of the year. Let's see how true that was.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. So this episode I want to talk about, well, I also want to continue to mention the Las Vegas Nopen coming up at the end of the month. We're having to adapt and overcome, you know, the challenges that are out there in various countries and stuff as we are planning this and dealing with this. But we're going to bring you 3 days of stellar content, live streamed, you know, basically going to try to bring a little bit of that tournament atmosphere, interesting things over the course of 3 days with some very talented and amazing streamers out there in the community. The link to the website, the Las Vegas Nopen, will be in the show notes. We're devoting all the profits that we make from the things like the t-shirts and stuff to charity. There'll be links to where you can get in on that. If you order your shirts and swag by the 15th, you should be able to wear it during the broadcast. And we're going to be doing some raffles and giveaways for social media promotions. If you use the hashtag, and if you know, it's maybe like one entry if you are wearing the shirt where you do it, or a hat or something, it may be 2 entries. I don't know. Details to TBD, but if you're interested in getting a shirt, if you order it now, or at least by the 15th, you should get it in time for the weekend. It's going to be a blast.
Pretty cool.
So on this, the topic of this show, actually a couple things I want to talk about. And one, we actually got a cool comment on the YouTube page basically saying like they don't know where to start with getting terrain for their table. And I thought that would be a great episode, like once we've done some little research about various different things for next week. So tune in next week and we'll have something about terrain and where to get started. And that'll be fun. But this week, I want to talk about the paradox or the fallacy, I'm not sure how to title this yet, of making decisions in a vacuum.
I think fallacy was good. I think that was a good one.
All right. Yeah, we had a little bit of talk about this in the pre-show, and yeah, Red's got me all wound up.
Yeah, hopefully I got the worst out of my system.
Well, no, you brought up it actually. I mean, I don't want to steal the thunder. You had a great point. That was actually like where I wanted to take us in the conversation is, you know, are you ever in a vacuum?
And what do you guys think? I'll definitely deliver my judgment here momentarily.
I don't think that like the vacuum really exists because you have so much like experience, but you also have conditioning and biases and all of that stuff. So I don't think that a vacuum could exist personally.
No, I actually kind of don't think we are. Like you can have a relative vacuum. Like you can try and look at things through as small a lens, as small a scope as possible for you. But like a true vacuum would essentially be like removing bits of knowledge from your brain. Like it's almost just not going to be a thing. But I mean, when we talk about 40K, yes, you can look at things in a vacuum. Like, and that vacuum pretty much is like a single codex or a single faction or a single mission or secondaries. Like you can do things like that. But a true vacuum, like I'd almost have to forget that all the other factions in 40K exist to truly measure up. Like, is a Vanguard vet better than a Sterngard vet, et cetera, et cetera. Like, even though like Vanguard vet is better,
Well, yeah, so are you talking sense? About like armyless design? Because you know that's one way to doing is if can we?
Yeah.
What are we deciding on what's good in an army list if we don't know what's out there? Most people are taking.
So the simplest, well, I guess the simplest example for 40K, yeah, is army list design is weighing up different choices within a faction. 40K having a bajillion faction options, unit options for each faction. It really gives you a lot of instances of needing to make those kind of decisions, but. Like making a choice in a vacuum in list design is actually a mistake. And I think we could probably agree weighing things up in a vacuum for list design is a mistake. Now, is that saying the same for secondaries, things of that ilk? I don't think so. I think secondaries and things and mission structures and deployments can be weighed up in a vacuum and maybe should in some instances. But as for army list design, yeah, like vacuum where you have to when it's like, oh, it's X versus Y in this example, but you're much better off taking as many factors into account as possible.
Yeah, so I guess looking, even if it's our own personal biases are not necessarily a bad thing when we're talking about unit choices.
Yeah, I guess that's the best example. But yeah, unit choices, it's always weird. Like, I mean, you've got personal preference and like to and personal bias, like you said. I suppose that's the hardest one to remove. Like, I can at times turn off factoring in what my friends play against, and I can I know what. Let's say I'm going to go play a friend in a pickup game, and I know he always plays Eldar. I can actively choose not to play Deathwatch, which is better against Eldar than let's say Raven Guard.
Eldar are good at doing two damage things, so you may not pay a premium for things with two wounds.
Yeah, exactly. So I might take guard instead of taking my marine armies, etc., and dodge the problem that way. But I can choose to not do that. You can actively make a choice to take away factors and look at things in isolation. And I think that's more important in the realms of our game. Unless you're literally brand new and you're like, is this Indominus unit better than this Indominus unit? Well, I like the shield, so the Blade Guard is better than the Eye Riders. And it can be as simple as that for a lot of people.
That's okay too.
Absolutely.
All right, Red. How wrong are we?
Oh, no. You're all right on point. That's the fun part about this is that when it comes down to it, there just is no such thing as a vacuum. And that what Adam said, spot on in regards to that sometimes when you make a calculation or factoring, you do go that direction where you have to reduce things in order to make a decision, right? Like, I mean, I think we all do that to certain extents in any case. When you're trying to make a decision, you have to reduce it down. And so, what does that look like? And the problem being is that what I think we're talking about when we talk about the vacuum is we're really talking about this extreme of controls, like when you conduct an experiment, just like Adam mentioned, that you essentially establish controls. Well, when you establish too many controls, you remove certain degrees of the reality from it, right? And so in a lot of like war theory and whatnot, you can go really two kinds of ways about it. You go in a kind of reductionist approach to it where you reduce things down to, okay, here's the objective and here's two hills or whatnot. If we just put this here and put this here and you apply this kind of pressure, like the enemy should fold, right? And my problem being is that, when you think about it, you're like, well, what do I know about myself? What do I know about the other army? What do I know not just about the game itself, but the other person? There's a lot more to it. And really that, at some point you have to limit the complexity and what you're trying to factor. And I think that that's where you have to strike a really strong balance in your decision-making process. And, we've talked about it some in regards of, I think we might have talked about it a little bit on our own, but the muscle memory kind of stuff, by doing things over and over again, it reduces the friction, right, that's associated with that decision-making process. Mm. And through repetition and understanding something, the deeper you understand it, the less time, obviously, it's going to take to get there. And so you don't necessarily need to do things in a vacuum. You can't just walk up and say, well, this is the math and this is, this is going to work. You have to factor in yourself, am I approaching this?
Your heart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, your instinct, right? And then you also have to factor in your opponent and are they making a biased decision? Is their process, are they suffering from analysis paralysis? What do they have it already figured out? Do they have a plan? Like that kind of stuff. There's a lot that plays into it. And so I think it's just impossible to really truly say that, you know, you can determine success in a vacuum.
I like how we play a turn-based game and how a decision on turn one might be a terrible decision, but on turn five, it's an amazing one.
Sure. Absolutely right. I suppose a lot of our ability to I guess, weigh these things up is determined by our kind of cognitive ability. The people who are able to make better decisions usually are the better players in 40K. Not always. Like, there are other ways to win games and be successful. But yeah, it's definitely a thing where your ability to take more factors into account rather than less in the start of the game is more beneficial. And then, like, it's almost the opposite when you get into those turns three, turns four, turn five. Like, turn five, I can be like, okay, I've got the bottom of the turn. I just need to, like, get on X, Y, Z objectives. Doesn't matter about shooting. Doesn't matter about anything else. I just need to roll two advance rolls and everything else is done for me. It's already set in stone. Like, the ability to ramp up your decision-making and then ramp it back down, like, narrow your vision. I suppose it's like optics, like it's like a lens to widen your lens and narrow your lens of decision making. I find is really beneficial as well, especially when I'm playing in like a large tournament, like five or six games, because you get to that sixth game, and I don't know about you guys, but as I'm getting older, game six sucks so much harder. Like, oh man!
Oh come on, man!
Oh dude,
not wrong.
So yeah, decision fatigue. It's a huge thing as well.
Well, you know, and yes, well, you say this is that, and you hear coaches, you know, especially on TV shows and stuff, they talk about the fundamentals. Yeah, but even establishing a firm set of fundamentals for yourself or for your army, and that's where some of the folks that I think are just longtime single faction players that really know their army in and out can win. They can get more wins than maybe what they're on paper their army people may think they should do.
Yeah, so you're talking guys like maybe Skari from Skycast, who's literally just a Dark Eldar player and mashes it up, spices it up with other Eldari when he, you know, on the odd occasion. And yeah, he's able to stay relevant edition after edition, meta after meta, FAQ after FAQ, because his decision-making is so precise.
Yeah, like some of the strengths and weaknesses of his army, he knows them in and out and can rely on them and that affects his decision making. So even if he's playing against someone who, and this is kind of where I was getting, is can you make decisions on the table without knowing your opponent's rules? And I think that you can. I mean, number one, to get out of that vacuum, you just say, hey, can I see your rules or can you explain your rules to me? Mm-hmm. But you're not going to digest someone's whole codex in the span of 10 minutes at the table.
Yeah, no chance.
It's not happening. You might understand what a specific stratagem does, and maybe that matters in that point in time, but you're not going to get the full width and breadth of the understanding of an army that you're not familiar with. Let's say they're playing all the new ad mech units, and you're not going to get it all. So what can you do? You can fall back on the fundamentals of your army and the objectives that you've chosen for yourself.
I think this holds true a lot more for these missions than ever before. I think in editions gone by, especially like ITC missions of the last edition, you really had to have a fundamental understanding of what your opponent was going to do to you in order to play. Now you can make a lot of decisions without factoring in what they're doing. You can really just play the primaries, maybe play one or two of your secondaries as well without having any input from your opponent and just be having to factor in where they're going to exist, not the damage they're going to do. I think that's very empowering to your point, Paul.
No, I just thought this might be a nice thing to talk about, how the vacuum, it's more, vacuums are more of a perceived than actual state.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, like, as a newer player and as somebody who's also switching factions, like, I don't have the same kind of, like, knowledge base that you all have when it comes to playing the game, but we were sort of talking about it before. I still sort of have the knowledge of sometimes who my opponent is, what I can expect of them or their play style, even what I know about my play style. So yeah, even as a new player, like, I don't think that the vacuum really exists.
Mm. So what's when you narrow your vision to decision-making, what's like the smallest you're able to go? What's the smallest instance of decision-making you think you're able to do?
Okay, so I've played the game for a really long time, but like competitively, I really only played for about a year and then COVID hit. So these are like big questions that I don't really sit down and even ask myself.
Cool. Fair enough.
Well, playing in the moment is, I mean, that's what the game's ultimately about. Anyway, but...
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, yeah, I don't know. The other thing, too, is, like, I am a very, like, reactionary player, so even when it comes to, like, list building, I sort of, like to build in that reactionality into my list, but I'm not really too sure like if that has anything to do with like decision making in a vacuum. I just don't think it exists. I don't know.
Sorry for putting you under the pump with a hard question. You said you were switching factions. What's that decision like? And how did you come to it?
Well, I played guard for that first year of like tournament play. And like I started playing in tournaments like I think it was like a month or two after starting coaching. So I didn't even really want to go to that tournament, but my coach was like, "Nah, you're gonna go." And I was like, "Okay." So I feel like guard was playing on hard mode for a really long time. Like a year of hard mode, and I was starting to get really like disheartened seeing like all the goodies and stuff that Space Marines have. So I was just like, and then under my coach's sort of guidance, he's like, well, why don't you just try doing something else, something that has maybe like a little bit more power, and see if you like it. So that's sort of like why I switched factions. I still didn't switch to Space Marines though.
Well done.
Yeah. That's okay. I'm still kind of playing on hard mode, just not as hard.
Yeah, I do. I like this discussion though, because I think it is when we can be there sitting at the table and we can feel like things are hopeless. You know, we can't see a path to victory. And I think that's, and when that's happening, we're mostly focusing on the unknowns and not necessarily taking stock of what we do know.
I actually think in my case, it might be the opposite.
Okay.
You know, we talked about like decision making in a vacuum in terms of looking at all of the units within your codex, and like comparing them to one another. But for me, I was starting to look at my guard codex and I was comparing everything against like the newer codexes. And I was like, I was just seeing that power imbalance and like the points disparity and all of that. And so maybe if I would have taken a step back and like looked at it in terms of the vacuum, I maybe wouldn't have needed to put my guard in timeout. But I definitely was comparing it to, you know, the goodies that other factions had.
That's okay. Maybe. Look, sometimes especially with codexes, it's easy for us to look at think the grass is greener on the other side.
In my case, the grass is greener.
No, especially with codex creep. That's a completely fair thing. And now I think in the previous edition and then as this edition unfolds, I think we'll see less of the codex creep type of thing, other than we'll just see more the folks that get their codex before the other factions will just get things unlocked for them that are more relevant to this edition.
Yeah, but the grass is also greener because I switched to orcs.
Literal greener.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
We did have some clamoring. We did have some clamoring I say clamoring. I'd like two people in the comments of the YouTube saying that we need the orcs podcast.
I'm into it.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
We're here for it. We'll have maybe October next year or this year. We'll launch a second one just for some sweet orc content.
I'm into it. I don't have time for it.
Yeah. You can listen though. You can listen while you're doing other things.
It's true.
All right. Well, so yeah, this is, you know, I start thinking, you know, when I sit down to build list or, you know, play against things. And as I think about how I might be unfamiliar with some rules or some factions that I haven't played as often, you know, because of our hazardous situation in our world right now, you know, what I'm going to be doing when the time comes on the table. And I started trying to think of like ways to mentally prepare myself for when that time comes, to where I start, you know, either thinking I'm making a decision without an uninformed decision. And then how to make sure that I focus on what's going to give me the most information. Cause I try, like in my game life and my professional life or whatever, I try to make the closest to a perfect decision as I can each time.
I think in the realms of 40K, I can say to some extent, the Australian, I guess, competitive meta more than anybody else plays to in a means that takes away, that, like, we build our stuff in a vacuum. So the people know Australia as a horde meta, like we play with bunches of models, and that's pretty much to guarantee you're always going to be able to get points in a game. Like I can tell you right now, for the people who make those lists and they're proponents of it, they're like, well, no matter what the matchup is, no matter how rough it looks on paper, I've got enough guys that are always going to get a decent score. Whether that wins or loses, you know, it remains to be determined.
Yeah, but a lot they could change. They've taken their destiny in their own hands. You know, with that yeah. type of style of build.
But absolutely right. But in the same setting, they've essentially written that in a vacuum. They're like, irrespective of who I play, irrespective of the meta, irrespective of the player, I have the resources necessary to play missions. And I said this before, this now more than ever with these missions, you can just play it. You can just play it. Doesn't matter what your opponent does or brings. You can, like, the only way he or she interferes with your score is by denying it. Or, you know, essentially you could not interact with each other and just play the mission and both get good scores. One of you win, one of you lose, or a draw. I don't think you've been able to say that for a long time. I mean, there's no way in the past ITC missions to do that, because you had to get kill and kill more, etc., in order to get the max on your primary. But yeah, at the moment, I think it's just a really exciting turn of events, a really exciting time.
All right. Well, folks, y'all made me feel better about sitting here thinking that I might potentially suck first time I start rolling out dice in public again.
Oh, yeah, you will. I was so rusty, man. First couple of games back. I think I just had my 10th game of 9th edition 2 days ago. So, yeah, I wouldn't worry. I think everyone's in the same bag in the same book. I do like how everyone's being really nice to each other at the moment. It's lovely. So, we've had barely any drama this year. Well, there's been no opportunities for drama, but I have a term. I don't know if I've said it on this, called the drama farmer, like the internet drama farmer. You just farm the drama, you cultivate the drama, you harvest the drama. It's yeah, and it hasn't been so much of it, which I'm grateful for.
Yeah, it's good. Look, and I'm not saying that we should be rushing back out into, you know, public play or anything like that. You know, safety is the primary concern here, but I am optimistic this year about things trying to get back to normal.
Well, it's a new year. We've got to be optimistic. What are you going to do? Walk in and be like, yeah, man, this one's going to be so much worse than the last one.
Hey, don't jinx us. Yep.
So if you spend a lot of time sort of theory crafting a list and like playing out eventualities and things in your head, does that also sort of ruin the idea of making decisions in a vacuum?
What do you think there is thrill in doing that?
Well, like, okay, so I have this weirdo orc list that I've been just thinking about for like 2 months, and sort of like tweaking it and stuff without actually playing it, because like I love my husband, but I'm not going to ask him to play me all the time because we get salty. So like I play out the game against like different matchups in my head with this list. So if I'm making decisions and I'm changing how I want to make this list without actually playing it, is that like, does that also take away that vacuum?
No, I think it does. Yeah. Because that's okay. Because you're kind of going through the paces. Like one of the things, Adam, I think you were mentioning before is how AdMech, you know, on like, if you could sit down and make an AdMech list and go, I have the number of shots to evaporate 80% of the armies that are out there. If your army is under X model count, you will not make it past turn 3.
Yeah, well, so I think it's a bit of a consensus now that AdMech on paper, AdMech is the best army in the game. They have a level of math that we haven't seen since the start of 8th edition, where they can literally just be like, doesn't matter what you take, as long as I can see you, it's going to die. And yet, it's only until very recently, while they are a very strong army, it's only until recently that they've actually started to put up some notable wins at tournaments, notable competitive achievements, I guess. And that's because despite the math, despite how crazy amount of shots and damage and XYZ they can do, you still got to play the mission. And the lists that take that weight of math aren't great at playing the missions. And so it's just been this really hard chew for a lot of people who thought, oh, AdMech's going to come in, it's going to be the best army in the game, it's going to make this huge splash. And they haven't been a wet noodle by any stretch. Like they haven't really, like they haven't been, oh, they're easy mode, don't worry about them, or we've got them covered, anything like that. But they certainly haven't been the quantity everyone thought they were going to be. And I personally know some AdMech players who have been disappointed. And not that, and I will say that with some chagrin and be like, you got nothing to be disappointed about, brother. Like they're incredible. Like, you know, but they're of the opinion that it's the grass wasn't as green as they thought it was going to be. Because a lot of these people, you know, only just started to play games now after sitting with their psychic awakenings and lists for, you know, months and months and months without playing games. And they get out there and have games and like,
with Blood Angels being just so amazing and then just not being able to play as much.
Well, these are people who've been sitting with the math, percolating on the math, and then they get out there and they're like, oh, dude, math doesn't win. Math, the math doesn't matter. And I will say the math does matter, but it doesn't. It's not the only factor. And well, thank God it's not.
Yeah, you're right. Because terrain,
the game would be a joke.
Yeah, we play a 3D game. Your opponent can look to deny some of you opportunity. I mean, that's really what an opponent should be doing in that situation. Look across the table and say, okay, you can annihilate my force if I just stood here. So I'm not going to stand there. Yeah.
Hmm.
You know, I'm going to stand somewhere else where you can only annihilate half my force, and I'm going to score points.
Yep, spot on.
Yeah.
And we're not a game where math is the only proponent. And thank God a lot of that is because we have, over the last two or three editions, we have upped our terrain count considerably to in order to compensate for how killy the last couple of editions have been.
Do you think that five inch like height is playing a factor in a lot of things, or
absolutely obscuring terrain is a big deal. And last edition, it was, you know, all bottom floor of ruins is considered to be blocking. That was also a massive deal for making the game playable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the game is built around that idea. Like we're not all, we call it what, Planet Bowling Alley.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, nobody wants to play that. And that's why I thought that, you know, the conversation that we had about keywords of terrain and then tying it into a full segment on what real tournament terrain should look like, or even what playable fun game terrain should look like. And nothing, take the tournament out of it. Like, how do you even make it functional for your home tabletop? And yeah, I thought it'd be a great conversation. That's, you know, so we will do that eventually.
That's a question I've always wanted to ask Red. I don't know whether this is the right time to do it, but let's roll. How much does math play in? I know logistics is a huge part of warfare and learning about warfare and battles and things, but how much is math even a thing in like real life combat? Well, is math even a consideration at all?
He just goes into every engagement thinking he's going to roll fives.
No, you're just going to roll sixes, man. Just roll sixes. That's it. That's all you got to do. So operational warfare, man. So warfare is the combination of science and art, right? And so when you say the science of warfare, I mean, there is absolutely 110% a science to it. And it can be factored into so many different degrees that, I mean, that's why this augmentation, this looking forward into the future, augmentation using artificial intelligence, whatnot. I mean, there's a reason why computers win so quickly at chess, right? I mean, it's all math computations. Well, I mean, it's all there. It's all, the physics are all present. I mean, okay, so if I have these weapon systems and we'll take a tank, for example, right? And it can go so far and it can shoot out, we'll say 2.5 kilometers, and it has this many rounds that can be expended within this amount of time. I mean, you could calculate out arguably in a vacuum, you could factor out, okay, this is going to take this long, and we're going to do this, and we're going to need this many resources back and forth. But then you start factoring, well, so in 1973, if I sent, over 7,000 tanks over the Golan Heights, and they got held up by a fraction of that, what's going to constitute them not being able to do what they're supposed to do mathematically? Well, that comes into the art of it, right? And so the art is this understanding the balance between everything and how things play into it. And the operational art, there's all kinds of elements that play into, you know, how you phase it, the tempo, the pacing, where you're going to, your operational reach essentially, and where you're going to culminate. Understanding all these factors across and then having the competency and the science to back it all up, I mean, that is going into warfare. And there's so much to it that that's just sticking your pinky toe in the water there, Adam. So I hope that remotely answered your question.
Yeah, well, it gave me a bit of scope for it, at least, just to know that how big a factor it is. I certainly thought, like, you know, operational wise, is a tank appropriate for XYZ battlefield, XYZ engagement? It seems to be, its range, its capabilities, and those things are all determined by the math and by the specs.
Yeah. Oh,
so
I mean,
certainly going to be some element.
When a tank, when a tank weighs over 70 something tons, and all your bridges are only weighted out to 60 tons, I mean, you scientifically have a physics problem there. You know what I mean? And if you understand that across 300 kilometers, I only have two bridges that can sustain this weight. I mean, you're facing a logistical issue, not just a tactical combat issue. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely all that science behind it. It's huge. It's massive.
It's pretty interesting. Yeah. So I know we've taken an interesting.
Oh, man. Have we jumped?
Yeah. Well, no, I think it's all relevant to at least the conversation of how do you arm yourself with the right information so you don't make blunders like that. And when can you theory craft yourself into a worse situation? I think it is both equally true on both sides.
Yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
That's a good point. Yeah, sorry if I took us a bit off the deep end. At least
it's a good topic.
No, no. I mean, and you know what? To get into all that, I mean, something that's kind of key to that is that, so there are staffs that just look at that, exactly that whole thing right there. And so those staffs, like a general staff, right? Like they break down, they essentially prevent the analysis paralysis. And by having that many people, it's supposed to be able to overcome it's supposed to grease the wheels on the decision-making process for the decision makers at multiple levels. And so that's how that kind of stuff. Whereas the cool thing about us playing war games, right, is that it simulates with varying degrees of accuracy in a competitive field, those similar kinds of decisions, except obviously you're not worried about how much fuel you have. You're not worried about running out of ammo or anything, but you're still making decisions at a tactical level that reflect that.
Yeah, cool. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back and we will talk more about 40K. I promise. See you in a few minutes.
You can't promise that.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I still got Adam in red.
Hello.
Hey.
Oh, hey. And Tanya Gates.
Hello.
We are back. Thanks for sticking with us. So we've been talking, we've been reading a lot, been talking a little about lore a lot, and the Warhammer 40K lore is often like littered with contradictions. And I think some of that is by design because the universe is so big and things are so epic that different people perceiving things could have a different take on things or different impression of what happened, or, you know, it's just somebody's retelling of a story and they could be lying, you know, or something. And so that type of contradiction has happened a lot in the Warhammer 40,000 side of the lore. And the Horus Heresy stuff, you know, we take more of those as like almost like we're a camera over the shoulder of some of the participants, you know, like we're getting that news report or actual eyewitness, accounts of things. But in 40K, it's a little hit or miss, I guess, with that. Recently, we've seen that the timeline that was established in the Dark Imperium is going to be, unwound, pulled back, turning back the clock. And I think that is the first time this has ever happened in Warhammer 40K.
Well, it just means that Cher finally had her wish and they did turn back time. And she doesn't need to ride that battleship anymore. She can finally get off after, 20 or 30 years and be like, I can rest now. So it's good for everybody.
Yeah, it's all a win.
This is a really interesting thing. I can't remember the last time they've actually announced that they're doing this. A lot of the times they just kind of do it without telling you. But I wonder what do you guys think? Why do you guys think this has happened?
So, I mean, I think that it's just a matter of consistency. When you're given like what happened in Psychic Awakening and where they're going with it, it's not, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it because there is such an enormity to it in certain regards. I mean, you take the 8th edition rule book that had all of that lore in it and all those things that happened and the time frame in which it happened. I mean, there's just a lot going on. And when you think about it, so Psychic Awakening and the Silent King was essentially, if let's say they left it where it was at, right? Let's say they didn't do the retcon. The Silent King would have happened before Dark Imperium.
Mm.
And I think that's a little hard to reconcile without saying it was handled to a certain extent. Now, that's not saying someone couldn't be around for that long, obviously, but the whole Psychic Awakening deal and everything, there's a lot going on. And so to what extent are they willing to kind of move on beyond it? And this kind of takes us back into the grim dark. Whereas, you know, so 200 years, Gilliman had essentially won the Indominus Crusade. Now it's 12 years or so. The Indominus Crusade is underway and about to begin. And yet the dilemmas are all around now because you've got Mortarion, you've got Magnus, you've got the Silent King, you've got everything, you know, and the Imperium is by no means necessarily in the best position. It's not in an advantageous position by any means, which I think it kind of had to a certain extent. It was definitely far better off had there been 200 years of it kind of getting itself back together. because, you know, you consider, I know Paul didn't bring it up, so he doesn't, you know, this is not a ding against him. But when you take the Blood Angels, and they were, I mean, the destruction of Baal, you know, they were taken out. They were reduced to a handful or a very small numbers by the Tyranids, and then the Warp Storm that followed it. And then Gilliman was supposed to show up and save them. I mean, that's kind of in the air, right? I mean, obviously he's going to save them, but that I haven't got a chance to read the Codex to see what or how they're adjusting that. I don't know if they did adjust in the Codex yet. That's kind of the interesting thing about this retcon deal, is it kind of catches up with itself.
Yeah, I've got a suspicion that they, firstly, I don't think the timeline of the game, sorry, and the lore matches up very well with some of the Codex releases. Like things like the Silent King, it doesn't make sense. They would just like rock up now, 200 years after the Great Rift, and, you know, the world, the universe, almost the galaxy almost collapsed in on itself, and Chaos almost won, when his whole plan is to deny Chaos. It makes all the sense in the world that he would show up shortly after the Gathering Storm as a result of it saying, hey, I'm needed again, back into the fold, let's get some things done, protect my people, you know, and then putting up all the barriers he's doing to create a null zone where the warp can't enter. It makes all the sense in the world. And to say that that was happening 200 years later, like, it's kind of a head scratcher. You're kind of like, that's a bit weird. It's a bit off. At the same time, G-Dub, so we were at this, like, 1 hour to midnight position, or 1 minute to midnight position in the lore since, I think it was fourth edition. Is that right? Maybe you guys will be able to tell me better.
You mean, like, just ever? I mean, that's...
How long had the 13th Black Crusade been going? Because the culmination of the 13th Black Crusade we've had, what was it? It was five editions of, like, the build-up towards Gathering Storm. The Gathering Storm was the culmination of the 13th Black Crusade.
Encroaching, so, you know, High Fleet Behemoth or whatever. Leviathan was the Leviathan.
Yeah.
I never
All these huge culminative plot points that have been built towards for decades. And they're kind of just baby with the bathwater went out the door when Indominus came out. And I think they've realized that might have been a mistake. We may have thrown out too much. And now we have to literally rewrite everything starting from 200 years later. And on top of that, we have to write what happened, what would have happened, and what would have been the outcome from those things anyway, for there to be some kind of continuity of fluff. And so I think they kind of backed themselves into a corner and realized the best thing to do is just kind of start over, but only 12 years, not 200. The other issue there is, though, and so this is where, so the Silent King now makes more sense, but the Indominus guys make less sense. The whole premise of the Blade Guard veterans was that they, like, Primaris had been around long enough that there were veterans now. The Indominus crusaded, well, Indominus veterans, etc. Well,
let me jump in here for just a second. Like, a veteran, I mean, you could just fight, you know, one or two campaigns and you're still a veteran.
Yeah. I mean,
you still get a few purity seals out of one battle.
Yeah, that does make sense. But you see where it's a little bit worse?
I'm not dismissing the point. Like, I do get it. Like, the idea that these all came about with where the original Primaris Marines were released without a bunch of the purity seals and fanfare and awards and regalia all over them. And we were told, and I believe it, that was by design, because they were kind of meant off the line, not recruits, but, you know, they have not been through the story. Yeah, the storied battles of these things that we come to appreciate with the Space Marines. But now, 200 years in the future, they were. But it doesn't, what I'm saying, it didn't have to be 200 years. What are we now? 15 to 12, 15 years or something in the future from when? And then we're all talking about from when Gilliman went in and spoke with the Emperor.
Right.
At the end of Psychic Awakening, how far are we along now?
I actually don't know.
That's what I'm saying. I think we're about, at least Dark Imperium is now happening like 12 years instead of 200. I think it's only been a handful of years. I think it was like five or something from him meeting with the Emperor now, instead of 200-ish years.
I feel like that's just a lot more palatable. Like, no doubt it takes like 200, take Gilliman 200 years to reconquer the galaxy and put everything right. But yeah, just jumping to that moment where the job's already done kind of feels bad. Like, there's so much fun we could have on the way.
He did the right thing. He gave half the galaxy to Dante, and of course he's going to make it right. Like, he only needed like 10 minutes, not 200 years.
Did I tell you I don't know if I was in on this podcast when I came up with this theory. I had this crazy, you know, you're sitting around at like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, at a bar after a tournament, and you just start talking absolute garbage with your mates.
Yes.
And I came up with this theory, you know, total pipe dream, that G-Dub was setting up for a second heresy. Because the Horus Heresy has been the biggest defining moment and the biggest plot point for the entire, you know, ethos, lore, whatever, of of the 40K universe. What if they were setting up for a second one, and the universe being cut in half, Dante and the guys who don't get Primaris Marines take over and become self-sufficient on that half of the galaxy, essentially a second Imperium of man over on that side, and that, you know, there's no contact with them for X amount of years. And then when the other one gets dominated by Primaris Marines, they end up taking over and becoming the mainstay. And then when they regain contact, the High Lords and Gilliman just try and force change on the other side, and conflict ensues. And I think that would be so freaking cool.
That would be neat. I think the humans have way too many enemies out there in the universe, though, for that to functionally happen. Like, the totally, part of the reason that humanity stands, you know, with the Shattered Emperor, is that their humanity can present a united front, I think.
And has the resources of like a thousand
a billion worlds. Or whatever.
Yeah.
But look, I'm not, who knows where we're going to get. I would not have expected Gilliman. I would not have expected half of the stuff from Psychic Awakening to have occurred. I mean, in my own fanfic, probably would have loved for it to happen. But with like Magnus making it to the moon and Gilliman coming out with the Emperor's sword, like, that's epic stuff.
Gosh, crazy, crazy cool.
But I think that you're right. I think, or at least we're close to the thing, is that when the story got advanced that many years, we lost a bunch of those 5 Seconds to Midnights, those plots that string together some of the context for many of the other factions.
Yes, yeah, so all they did was progress. They progressed Chaos and the Space Marines, essentially. And then everyone else got left in the dust.
Actually, only the Space Marines. I don't even think, I'd argue that Chaos did not even get advanced.
Well, yeah, like, I read the first novel. I didn't hear a single mention of Abaddon in that book. I have no idea what Abaddon was doing.
I would argue that only the Primaris got advanced for what is, I guess, what was decided to be a thin reason.
I mean, so yeah, you know, we didn't see any Chaos stuff until, I mean, Chaos, Abaddon. That was, you know, Vigilus Ablaze and Psychic Awakening, right?
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, there's no scandal here. The minute impact is so small. Yeah, we're advancing a fantasy timeline one way or the other, where the only thing that changed were the Marines, and the Marine players don't care. As long as you're not taking away the Outriders, we're all good here.
Dang.
Or, sorry, technically the Assault Intercessors. I don't care what time it is. I mean, but that would have been the real casualty, though, I think, is all those plots that things like the Tyranids and the Necrons had rooting them to the universe.
I don't really care too much about like continuity and like timeline and stuff. Like, what I get out of the novels is like character development and like a good story. So like the overarching sort of like timeline of the lore, it doesn't really, I don't really feel too strongly about it getting retconned. As somebody who's new to it, like, it kind of seems like oversight to, especially at a time when Black Library is one of your strongest performing departments in your brand, to push the storyline ahead so far without exploring a lot of the different relationships of the different factions within it first.
I think that's a great point. And just because there's been a lot of stories that have had time jumps, right? And how those time jumps are managed definitely has an impact. And I admit, I'm trying to think right now of the idea of a good time jump. The best time jump I can think of that comes immediately to mind is The Hobbit to Lord of the Rings. That's just out the gate. But I mean, there's plenty of other examples. And then there's plenty of examples where it didn't work. And I think that you know, it is a literary device. I agree, Tanya. It's something that, if not done appropriately, could require kind of maybe what we're looking at right now.
Well, the grand,
it's really hard when you're managing like so many different authors who all have their hands in the pot, right? Like, the reason why it worked with the Lord of the Rings is because it's one author developing the world.
It's a good point. Sure.
Well, D&D tried it also at one point in time when they jumped to fourth edition, and their authors kind of went along with it because they were getting, you know, they were told to essentially by TSR, and then I think they've slowly walked back that as well. But look, I'm not saying it can't work, and I'm not even saying it didn't work in this. I just think that they probably weighed the benefits of like the work that would have to be redone to fill in that time for all the other factions, and maybe decided to squirrel it back. Or maybe there's an amazing story right on the that's about to come out that needed the timeline to be there. But you know what you were talking about with the 40K lore almost being like episodic in nature, and that you used to read before the Horus Heresy, we would read 40K novels as just, this is just a 40K novel. It doesn't even matter where it happens, when it happens. This story is good because it's just a good story, or it showcases whatever I needed from it at the moment. Like this long continuity outside of the knowing that we had 10,000 years for the game to play, or for the lore to play with. You know, that's all that mattered. Had to exist sometime in that last 10,000 years. Like the Horus Heresy has changed it, I think, or changed our perceptions of what Warhammer sci-fi fiction should be.
Yeah, it's gotten so big and so vast that it really changed our perceptions. And look, I don't want anybody to loved that book and loved that novel. The Dark Imperium book, the opening chapter in that book of Gilliman fighting Fulgrim, when Gilliman essentially, you know, ends up in a coma, and then it follows his story when he wakes up again, and et cetera, is incredible. Getting that little bit of story told, like Fulgrim actually outmaneuvering and defeating and forcing Gilliman into a confrontation he can't really win, and, you know, forcing him to go for a Hail Mary, essentially forcing him to try and duplicate what happened on the Vengeful Spirit out of like sheer spite, is so, so freaking cool. I highly recommend it. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that in a year or two, the fluff can't be back to where it was, like 200 years in the future. But I just think the intervening story should be told. I think there was so much going on where we left off that to ditch it and just jump ahead 200 years. Yeah, I said it before. I think it's throwing the baby out of the bathwater.
They obviously agree with you. So, I mean, that's...
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's nice to be right. Sorry.
Hey, look.
I just think going forward, because it's like a living game that's like the books themselves are also, and the editions themselves are also furthering the storyline, I just think it's you have to be so concrete in your vision of what you want to jump ahead like that. And it's just, I think it's better for the storyline if they sort of leave it sort of more fluid in like a shorter time frame, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I think that's more of what we're used to with 40K stuff. You know, I mean, look, there have been some great books, like obviously stellar 40K books, but they could have been anywhere in any point in time. But now this is almost like kind of like a casualty of advancing the story, because really for 30 years, the story didn't advance much. And now we have decidedly advanced. I don't know if we factored that into our thoughts until just now.
Yeah. When I first saw that we were going to get some story progression, I was over the moon. How did you guys feel? Like, because the lore was stale. Was stale as hell. We had been locked into this single mode for so long.
I don't know that it's stale. I don't know that it was stale. But I was also, I still am very enthusiastic about advancing the story. And I think that bringing a Primarch back, you know, a living demigod, was a great way to do it.
Mm.
And it is a cool model. So there we go.
It is still very interesting to me. We haven't seen another Primarch. Am I right in my recollection that G-Dub said that like we were going to have most, if not all, the Primarchs back?
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
I don't think you've ever heard that from
talking with my mates around the campfire.
That sounds like a lot of wishful thinking, which is not saying it's bad.
They're going to stick Ferris's head back on. Sweet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's all kind of, you know, videos out, you know, people theorizing and lore theory about doing just that. Like, I mean, let's not forget that there have been clones of Horus, you know, in the lore for a long time. And I also think Drago is one, but it's for another time.
I thought you were going to say a Blood Angel, and I'm kind of disappointed you didn't, but also happy.
So, well, I mean, don't get me wrong. I could probably plot a pretty interesting story about how Sanguinius could come back, but I do legitimately think Drago is a clone of Horus.
Well, Sanguinor. Let's just say the Sanguinor is a manifestation of Horus's regret. Bang, done. Write two novels.
There's already lore that kind of says what the Sanguinor is.
Retcon it. Mine's better. sorry, guys. I'll stop.
Yeah. You get one thing kind of right.
run with it. It's off.
Now I'm just probably being intolerable.
But we still get, look, one of the cool thing is we still get to have these, like the time retcon basically means nothing. It has no negative impact on anything, I don't think.
Yep.
And we still get to have these kind of what if conversations.
The actual fluff getting retcon. Yeah. It can't be a bad thing. Can't be a good thing. It's just going to be what it is.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm excited though to see what comes next in the 41st millennium. Like I do look forward to these stories that have these evolving timelines and stories and advancements of characters that, you know, are epic, universe shifting, defining things.
Mm. If they're going to bring anyone back, can they bring back Argyltal? He's the babe.
Beloved. No spoilers, man. Come on.
Oh, jeez. Fair.
Well, we still get to have these conversations about the what-ifs, and is Drago a Horus clone? Is Fulgrim ever going to get a model in 40K? You know, we get to...
I already did, man. Didn't you see Sigvald?
That is so gorgeous.
Beautiful. Oh, new... So the diorama-rama continues with the Slaanesh chariot dude, Gluttonous McGluttony.
We can jump to talk about that. Was it the New Year's preview or whatever?
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about it?
Yeah, Dan. It's real good, guys. I'm looking forward to it coming out.
So in the New Year preview, we got I mean, it's the full-on image of Glutos or Solion.
It's pretty much the manifestation of how we're all going to look emerging from COVID lockdowns.
With all the dope stuff we bought on the internet.
In a chariot behind.
Oh, yeah. Oh, can I get that chariot? It's DIY.
And all the extra pets we got to keep us from being lonely.
Can I get that crab giant on Amazon Prime?
If you could own a crab giant, surely you would.
Look, so you know I'm down for any model that brings its own snacks. And this one does not disappoint.
It's gorgeous though. Like, I love the design of it. It's very on par with the rest of the kind of recent diorama-ish models. You've got the guy on the chariot-esque thing with his two, you know, right hand and left hand guys, and then, you know, he just happens to be pulled by some beasties.
Well, what was that old world model that had the two, the war shrine? Is it the Chaos War Shrine?
Being carried by the two ogres.
Yeah. And so this is reminiscent of that, and it's got almost that kind of greasiest gold tooth kind of feel to it.
That's true. Yeah, good harken back there.
I mean, but this is obviously a mortal Slaanesh. But I love models like this. I mean, the bits on this thing, you know, are stellar. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. And I think this thing is going to be just absolutely just a target for conversions for things.
Yeah, I agree. The pool of bits that is going to come out of this dude is going to be incredible.
Yeah, and it looks. I mean, I know some of this is paint job, and it was got that mirror. So the staff, like, look at the zoom in of the dude himself on the dais. And I don't know if you noticed that, but the dais itself, not only is it being pulled by those two giants, it's got like carved into it like marble statues that are supporting something or holding something all around it.
It's on the back too.
Yeah.
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 I'm a big fan.
Out of control.
I don't quite know how big it is though. Like, I don't have a representation for scale yet, because I guess none of the new Slaanesh dudes or Slaanesh models have been released yet. So we actually don't know how big they are. But I'm assuming
on a knight base.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And he takes up the whole base. So he's pretty big, chunker.
Yeah, I mean, that has to be a knight base.
I mean, unless he's got his own sized oval base, there's really no other sized oval bases out there, is there?
Well, you
got
to think that the ogres, you know, they would be on a 40 mil, or see, even, you know, potentially 60 mil, but at least 40 mil or 50 mil round.
Yeah, well, I think ogres in AOS, like Ogre Moor tribes, they're on 40 mils, the standard infantry.
Yeah, so these...
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, these have to be... It has to be a knight base.
I think that's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah. No, this is... I mean, look, if this is what we have in store for us, I mean, we already know there's good... You know, we had no shortage of great models last week to talk about for our potential best model of 2020. I mean...
Well, we got it wrong. We didn't pick Gad.
Well, it was opinion-based, right? But we didn't... We had no... We could talk... There was at least 5 or 10 other models we could have spoken about, I think, during that conversation.
Yeah, I stand by my pick. Void Dragon, mind-blowing. And the the big, the Super Gargants, whatever they're called. Love them.
Yeah. No, those are solid picks. It's completely okay. And keeping that purple, I don't want to say Slaanesh, but Emperor's Children thing going. What is it? The model for Saul Tarvitz is going to be going up for sale on Forge World soon.
Nice. Am I crazy? Ever since I've seen that model, I thought it was plastic. It looks like plastic. It doesn't look like resin. I mean, it's painted, of course, but I don't know. It just looks like a plastic model to me.
He may be for sale now. Yeah, he is up for, temporarily out of stock. So don't, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to send anybody on a wild goose chase. That model is now up, or at least it's in the web cart and, get signed up for alerts.
Yeah, and I only mentioned that it looks plastic just to point out that how good like Forge World resin has become. Like, yeah. It looks phenomenal. Such a well-detailed face.
This model, if you're playing with Firstborn and you need a captain, I don't think it would take much to switch out his shoulders and get this, have an amazing relic blade or, you know, burning blade captain.
Yeah, know. Agreed. Yeah, he is fantastic, and I'm just happy he's got a model. I mean, are we going to get Rylanor, the old loyalist dreadnought that was there at the end?
I don't remember that guy
with Tarvis, ancient Rylanor. Oh, I might be saying it wrong, but yeah, legend.
I don't know if I remember that guy.
Yeah, he was there he was there with Saul when they were purging their own legions in Is it okay if I spoil this one? You know, it was like,
well, that was like in the third book, right?
But you know, the fifth is like the seventh or eighth book, whatever betrayal was. That one's out. I was out of line.
Spoil away.
No, apologies. Yeah, when they're virus bombing, Isvan, was it 3 or 5? I can't remember which one.
Yeah.
But they
3.
Where Tarvis went down, the ancient Rylanor was there with him, and he was a dreadnought that survived it all. He survived long enough because he sealed all his vents, and so he was there to kick when they came down. It was actually pretty cool.
Nice. Well, folks, let's go ahead and wrap it up. Red had to drop a little bit ago, but then this has been, I'm interested to hear what the thoughts on the first part of the show are, if people kind of struggle with that or have already overcome that in their games and in their list building. And any comments that people share on that, you never know what's going to resonate with somebody else. So, you know, let us hear them so we can pass them along as well.
Lovely.
Yeah. Well, for Red, I'll say good night, and Tanya and Adam, thanks for being here.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for having me. Good night. Hopefully I wasn't too bad.
We'll see y'all soon.
See ya.
Puts baby in the corner.